Pittston to Du Bois, State College to White Oak, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, climate change is being blamed for everything from hot summer temperatures to the tropical storm that hit California. But the reality is we are in a natural warming cycle, which government policies cannot change. We get details from Greg Wrightstone of the CO2 Coalition. And the first Republican presidential debate is in the history books. Predictably, economic issues were a main topic. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, has this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Greg Wrightstone in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. The Pennsylvania State Senate will reconvene on Wednesday to take further action on the 2023-24 state budget. Senate President Pro Tempore Kim Ward said the chamber will act on funding for emergency medical services along with hospital and health system relief. That is only a small part of the over $1 billion in funding awaiting approval of what is known as a fiscal code. That approval has been held up following Governor Josh Shapiro's breaking of a deal he negotiated with Senate Republican leaders to include the $100 million Lifeline Scholarship Program, now renamed PASS, as House Democrats have objected to the program, which would provide new educational opportunities for students trapped in the state's worst-performing public schools. Despite the remaining work which needs to be done on the budget, the House does not plan to return until September after a three-month-long adjournment. Governor Josh Shapiro's ambition to run for president of the United States is well known. He further fueled that speculation by accepting an invitation to keynote the New Hampshire Democratic Party convention next month. New Hampshire holds one of the earliest primaries and is often a make-or-break venue for candidates. It should be noted Shapiro is looking ahead and laying the groundwork for a potential White House bid in 2028. The long legislative summer recess has left the date of the 2024 presidential primary election in Pennsylvania up in the air. The primary currently is scheduled for Tuesday, April 23rd. However, there has been the usual quadrennial chatter over holding the primary earlier to enhance Pennsylvania's say in the presidential nominating process. April 23rd also falls during the Jewish holiday of Passover, so the potential for a change in date is greater than in past years. An earlier primary would also impact elections for Congress, State Senate, and State House, as the three-week period for candidates to secure signatures to obtain ballot access could be advanced into this year's holiday season. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Every weather-related event is seized upon by climate change extremists in a rhetorical effort to advance their goal of expanding government control over the economy, this under the guise of affecting the climate. Greg Wrightstone is executive director of the CO2 Coalition. He is best-selling author of the book Inconvenient Facts. He is here to set the record straight with actual scientific data. Greg, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Greg, there have been a number of weather-related stories, whether it be the heat in Arizona, whether it be the fire that took place on Maui, the recent storm that hit California. In each case, those who wish to, pardon the pun, fan the flames of climate change, blame climate change on that. So let's talk about each of those individually and whether climate change is actually at fault. First of all, talk a little bit about the weather. It's been very hot in parts of the United States, but it is indeed summer. Is what we're seeing actually, as the hysterics have sometimes been, the hottest days in the history of the planet?
Not hardly. July temperatures, if you look at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, their satellite data, which I think is the best, it barely broke the record for the longest ever recorded. But of course, that record only goes back to 1979. And as I recall, there were a lot of Julys before 1979. So we're in a warming trend. It's only reasonable then that the recent temperatures are a little bit warmer than those 30 years ago. That's to be expected in a warming trend. But if we look at heat waves, that's been the real push here, is that heat waves are hotter and longer. There's more of them. And that's just factually incorrect. If you take a look at heat waves throughout the United States, Pennsylvania, any of the states in the United States, virtually all had huge heat waves back in the 1920s and 30s, 90 years ago, that were dwarf anything we see today. But they need to lie about that. A great example, Lohman, is if you go to the EPA website, or if you Google EPA and heat waves, you'll see a chart of what appears to be alarming increase. It's called the heat wave index. They used to have a chart up there showing heat waves in the United States that showed, in fact, that heat waves peaked in the 1920s and 30s and were significantly lower numbers today. But they replaced it with this heat wave index. And I took a deep dive into what actually that is. It turns out that it's the 50 largest municipal areas in the United States. It's not regular thermometer measurements out in the boonies someplace, but this, and we know that for a fact that we've got what's called the urban heat island effect, with artificial warming of all the cities, and that's what they're using on their website. What they don't talk about in the media, when it was screaming hot in Texas, the northwest of the United States was unusually cold. At the same time, they were talking about heat in Italy, northern Europe, and the United Kingdom were at near record cold temperatures, but they don't talk about. In fact, they were handing out blankets and hats in the United Kingdom, and the Queen of Tonga was handing out blankets in the South Pacific island of Tonga that they've never done before because it was so cold. But that doesn't get reported. What they're doing is using each event to just stoke a climate of fear in order to get their harmful, economically crippling proposals and regulations passed. So if we're not in a climate emergency, why on earth would anybody welcome or gladly accept 4 and 5 times increase of electricity cost? Why would we accept being told what kind of car to drive, dishwasher to buy, how to heat our homes, and the like? It's they need to stoke this climate of fear.
I was going to say here, Greg, it seems like there is an ulterior motive behind all of this because the science is suspect that they're really trying to gain control over our economy as opposed to necessarily fighting climate change, don't you think?
Oh, it is, especially if we take a look at the tiny amount of warming that would be averted by us going if we went to net zero. It's an incredibly small amount. In fact, if we went to net zero in the entire United States, it would avert less than 1/10 of 1 degree of warming by the year 2100. And again, China and India are just going gangbusters with opening more coal mines, mining more coal, using more coal for electricity, and creating more coal-fired electricity generation facilities. They're dwarfing any reductions, which is, we are reducing our CO2 emissions, but not by much.
You referenced the fact that the one measurement went back to the late 1960s, which, of course, is not really all that long ago. In your book, Inconvenient Facts, you actually went back almost to the beginning of recorded time. So in terms of warming periods, as you look over not dozens of years, but hundreds, even thousands of years, are we really in one of the warmer periods of time?
Sure we are. We're in the what I call the modern warming period or the current warm period. It's been warming now for more than 300 years. If you go back to the Industrial Revolution, we've warmed about 1.2 degrees centigrade Celsius. And bear in mind, Lohman, they're warning us we can't allow warming, the temperature, to rise more than 1.5 degrees since that time. Well, it's already risen 1.2 degrees. So what do they warm? They're telling us we can't allow it to get 3/10 of a degree Celsius warmer than it is today. That's half a degree Fahrenheit. If you're sitting where you are in your studio, you couldn't tell if it got half a degree warmer or half a degree colder. The thermostat wouldn't kick on. And if you're that worried about warming of 0.3 degrees, move 17 miles further north. And that's what you would get. You would experience 1/2 of a degree Fahrenheit cooler temperature, which is what they're warning. When you look at it in that context, it's just silly. It's ludicrous.
It sounds to me like you're not denying that there is climate change. You're just saying it's something that has been underway for hundreds of years and is a normal part of the cycle.
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, if you look at the past warming periods and look at human history, there's a strong relationship between the rise and fall of temperature and the rise and fall of civilizations and empires. And each of the past warming periods, the Minoan, the Roman, the medieval warm periods, were all associated with bountiful food, great empires and civilizations. And each of those times when it started cooling, all of those great civilizations and empires collapsed during the cooling period. Each one of those cooling periods was associated with crop failure, famine, pestilence, and mass depopulation. It's completely opposite of what we're being told. You're being told, fear the heat. No. Human history tells us, welcome the warmth, but we should fear the cold. Because cold, despite what Joe Biden claimed last week, cold kills 10 to 20 times as many people as does heat. Cold is the great killer. And no matter, every study that we've looked at recently sees at least tenfold increase of deaths related to cold. So what's that tell me? Global warming saves lives is what that tells me.
We are hearing the most recent example of blaming climate change for a tragedy, the fact that California, for the first time in, what, some 80 years, has had a hurricane the hurricane came ashore in Mexico, and it's a tropical storm. It is dumping an unusual amount of rain over California and the American Southwest. Is that something to be blamed on climate change?
There's so few of these. Again, I don't think there's been one to hit the West Coast for many, many, many decades. I haven't had time to digest this, but we do know that in terms of hurricanes in the Atlantic Ocean, they're not increasing for sure.
We are talking with Greg Wrightstone, who is executive director of the CO2 Coalition, also author of the book Inconvenient Facts. Another book coming up. We're going to talk about that in just a couple of minutes. But Greg, let's talk about Hawaii, about Maui, about the wildfire that just created utter devastation on that community. That is being blamed on climate change by some, but in a bit of a different way. It appears that the electric company in that area deferred maintenance and enhancements to the electrical lines in order to comply with climate change regulations imposed by the state. What do you make of all of that?
Well, yeah, there have been several reports over the last couple of decades warning of the fire danger at Lahaina. Now, bear in mind, those reports didn't foresee anything of this devastation, but they did report and predict and made suggestions of what should be done. And let's be clear what the cause is. There are a number of things working here. The hurricane or cyclone, Hurricane Dora, that passed some 700 miles south of the island. The winds had nothing to do with hurricane. The winds that came down were the main cause of the disaster by felling electrical lines. But these are called Lahaina winds that come down off the mountain. The winds rush up over the top and then have a cascading effect down the other side heading, and they're funneled by the gorges and the ravines to the city there. They get these a couple or three times a year, and it looks like about every 12 years, they get these really bad winds like we had here. And these winds, just like the Santa Ana and Diablo winds in California, they're extreme. They get, as they're rushing down, they gain heat, dryness, and speed. And it can dry out grasses within a matter of a couple of hours, even if it had rained the day before. And again, when we talk about the grasses, this whole area around Lahaina had been an agricultural area. They were growing. The fields were covered with pineapple and sugarcane. All the processing plants closed down a couple of decades ago, and all of those fields have now reverted to grasses, invasive grasses, I might add. And so if you look at a Google Earth picture of the area around Lahaina before the fire, which I've done, you can just see that whole area is just covered in these brown grass. And these grasses are, and that's what led to this. Grass fires can move very quickly. And the grass, again, can dry out within a matter of an hour or two with these hot, dry winds. It could have rained for 2 days before the fire, and it would have had scarce any effect because it dries out that quickly. But the electric company, the advice to them were to have fire boundaries, fire breaks around the town. Anyone living out away from any city should have a fire break around their home to cut down on those invasive grasses. And Loman, right now in the eastern United States, almost all of the East Coast woodlands are now covered with Japanese stilt grass. And it's an invasive species throughout the mountains. And I've been predicting for some time that the next time there's a big drought in that area, where we have the potential in the east to see wildfires like they have in the west, grass fires fed by this dry Japanese stilt grass. Thankfully, we haven't had a super drought for many decades.
On the legal front, Greg, and I know you monitor these things very closely as well, a recent case in Montana sent a bit of a shockwave through the system, where a judge found some sort of a right to not have climate change. Can you fill us in a bit on the details?
Yeah, it was called the Climate Kids lawsuit. They were, I think, 15 or 17 at the time when they filed it, ranging from 2 years old to 17, that said that they were being prevented from having a pristine environment, that the state had a duty to in their constitution to protect them. And the judge, their allegations they were just completely false and easily debunked, which we're in the process of doing now. For example, they claimed that between 1970 and 2015, the number of 90 degrees days increased by 20 days. Well, turns out that's right, but they just cherry-picked an interval. I mean, they have data. We have data. We took it back to 1895, and we took it to 2023 to find out that the number of 90-degree days 90 years and 100 years ago in the 20s, 30s, and 40s was about the same as it is today. There was a period of time when in the 70s where it was down. That's why they cherry-picked that data. And so we've exposed that for being false. Their claim of additional droughts is just false. We show the precipitation. This is Montana, mind you. And we show document for sure precipitation has been increasing slightly in Montana. And that's a good thing. So we're systematically, we'll be publishing this over the next couple of weeks. We did a report on Pennsylvania. We've got a whole series of state and regional reports. We just published one on the Midwest, and you can get this information at co2coalition.org. We also published one on Virginia. The one on the Midwest was called The Midwest and Climate. The America's breadbasket is doing good and getting better. So, and that's what we see. We see Earth's ecosystems and humanity are actually thriving and prospering.
One of the common threads I'm sensing in your explanation of all these issues, Greg, is that when it comes to data and so-called science, as you put it, there seems to be a lot of cherry picking. They determine what the lengths of time were, what they're particularly studying, and then spin it to advance the climate change narrative. Do you see that as you do your research? Is that a large part of what the CO2 Coalition has to do, is to come back with actual fact?
Oh, my, yes. It angers me so often that they're either flat out lying to us, or misrepresenting the data, cherry picking, or using statistics to come up with a contrived. They come up with the answer first, and let's see how we can interpret the data to make it look this way. They did that with, for example, natural disasters. The reporting. They started reporting natural disasters. This MDAT-CRED, it's called. It's in the Netherlands. And they started this in 1970, and were building out their network. The UN report that came out claimed a fivefold increase in natural disasters over the last 50 years. Well, the first 30 years of that, from 1970 to 2000, it was an increase in reporting, and we admitted that. We had their director of Regina Below, their director of data, actually responded in an email that confirmed that it was reporting increases, not actual disasters. And since they built that out, we've seen a 10% decline in natural disasters, completely opposite of what the headlines blared of a fivefold increase. And again, they're just using statistics to craft their foregone conclusion.
Well, the CO2 Coalition, one of the components of your mission there, Greg, is to educate people. I understand you have a new project. Could you tell us a bit about your latest educational project?
Our members were very concerned about the state of science education in America. Our students are being indoctrinated. They're being taught indoctrination and groupthink rather than the scientific method and critical thinking skills. We've done something to change that. We've created a website, co2learningcenter.com, co2learningcenter.com. In it, you can get our comic, science-based comic books and science-based videos. And the important thing here, Loman, we've created lesson plans that homeschool parents can use, the charter schools can use. They were created by Dr. Sharon Camp, who's got a PhD in analytic chemistry. She's an AP science teacher, still a reader after she retired. But she's created these wonderful lesson plans. And so the homeschool communities, we just launched this a month ago and attended the Southeast Homeschool Expo in Atlanta 2 weeks ago to great acclaim. It's something I'm really proud of. So co2learningcenter.com.
Greg Wrightstone is executive director of the CO2 Coalition, also author of the best-selling book, Inconvenient Facts. Speaking of books, understand you have a new one coming out in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, actually, I've got the summary to write, and it's done. It's off for editing and formatting now. The title is A Very Convenient Warming, How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. It's the story that needs to be told of ecosystems that are thriving and prospering. By almost every metric we look at, our ecosystems are improving, not getting worse, and humanity is benefiting from that through increases in crop growth, increased vegetation from the near polar regions to the equator. So we should celebrate that.
Well, we're going to look forward to that and look forward to you debating the left whenever the book comes out. And you always seem to leave them in the dust for some reason, Greg. Greg Wrightstone of the CO2 Coalition. Again, the web address for the CO2 Coalition would be?
co2coalition.org, co2coalition.org.
Greg Wrightstone of the CO2 Coalition. Greg, good to have you back with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Loman.
Republican presidential candidates have taken to the debate stage, and Bidenomics was in the crosshairs. Emily Green of Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, has this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
On August 23rd, Republican presidential hopefuls took the stage in Milwaukee to show right-of-center primary voters and the world why they are best suited to take on President Joe Biden in his bid for a second term in office. President Joe Biden's disastrous fiscal policies were, predictably, high atop the list of topics for discussion on the Wisconsin debate stage. Even the least politically involved Americans are feeling the impact that Bidenomics has on their wallets. On average, the price of a cup of coffee is up 32% since 2021, and the price of eggs has more than doubled. Hosting a Labor Day barbecue next weekend? The price of beef and chicken is up about 30% since the 46th president took office. Presidential hopefuls rightfully attributed rising costs across the board to the current administration's rampant federal spending, to the tune of about $10 trillion. The candidates signaled that our country is at a dire crossroads, and we can turn this ship around, but we need a leader who can appeal to the masses to right the wrongs that stem from Bidenomics. To rid Washington of ideas and policies that serve as a direct attack on the pocketbooks of hardworking Americans, we need a new face to lead the fight towards fiscal sanity. And Americans for Prosperity has determined that the GOP must appeal to the masses by embracing a new leader to lead the Republican ticket. According to 538, as of August 17th, former President Donald Trump has an unfavorable rating of 54.6% amongst Americans, comparable to President Joe Biden's 54.5% unfavorable ranking posted on the same day. With former President Trump's 100% name recognition and high polling numbers amongst likely Republican voters, many right-leaning potential voters may fear a false choice between voting for the status quo or a rematch against Donald Trump versus Joe Biden. Trump's high polling numbers amongst likely Republican primary voters track, however, and make sense in the short term. In 2016, then-business mogul Donald Trump swept the PA Republican primary with 56% of the vote, though only 1.6 million of the 3.3 million registered Republican voters in PA even bothered to turn out. When the general election of 2016 rolled around, Trump was only able to claim victory in Pennsylvania by less than 1%, signaling a lack of support with likely Republican general election voters. In 2020, during the 45th president's re-election, he lost the Commonwealth by a slightly more decided 1.6%. President Joe Biden's unfavorable numbers are real, and this proves to be a great opportunity for Pennsylvanians to fight to take back the Commonwealth and share that taxpayers are ready to move past 4 years of tax and spend policy that hinders economic prosperity for all. However, we must do so by turning the page and providing an alternative to the status quo candidates that can't appeal to a large, yet quiet, group of right-of-center voters that feel uninspired by the current political climate. Americans for Prosperity CEO Emily Seidel was quoted recently in the Wall Street Journal by sharing, "The way we've been looking at it this whole time is that the most likely outcome is that President Biden and former President Trump are the nominees. In that situation, Biden wins. And what we know is that Americans can't afford 4 more years of spending-fueled inflation and an administrative state that's on steroids and on and on." So, instead of banking on an inevitable choice between two candidates, we can open other voters to the idea of a new free market-driven, fiscally conservative administration that appeals to voters of all ideologies. Forging the path towards a new chapter for fiscal conservatism will take work, but Americans for Prosperity PA has already talked with over 100,000 likely Pennsylvania voters on their doorstep or over the phone. In order to provide a Pennsylvania electorate with a new choice, we will need to expand the pool of voters by 10 to 15%. We're hearing that the economy and inflation are the top-ranking issues that would drive these non-likely Republican primary voters to turn out to the polls, and among the likely Trump supporters in this group of voters, 41% would be open to another candidate. Unfortunately, 60% of these voters feel that the country's best days are behind us, but that signals an electorate that, despite their choices in Republican presidential primary candidates, remain united against President Biden's economic policies. Join our movement for more. Help us reignite the American dream by heading to AmericansForProsperity.org and following on social media at AFP Pennsylvania on Twitter and at AFPPA on Facebook. This is Emily Green, Deputy State Director with Americans for Prosperity PA.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 28 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WMSS-FM in Middletown, WKFB-AM in Gannett, and WKHB-FM in Irwin, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. ¶¶